These opening words are the global chalice lighting for November 2009. You are welcome here, visitor, friend, or longtime member. You are welcome here. With your family or partner or lover or alone, we joyfully welcome you here. You are welcome here as believer or doubter, as joiner or loner. You are welcome here, feeling a part of us or not, full of energy or plain tired, seeking a vision or a rest. You are welcome to join us as you are. Now is the time for centering. The spoken prayer today is by Theodore Parker. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living.
My reading this morning is from a book titled Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard. And many of you know her works, and you know that she has written quite a number of books since then, but this happens to be the one that I like the best, so I go back to it fairly often and reread it. She actually is a poet, a naturalist, a memoirist. She has a lot of ways of explaining what life is to her, and this is one of the ways that she has encountered life. Learning to stalk muskrats took me several years. I've always known there were muskrats in the creek. Sometimes when I drove late at night, my headlight's beam on the water would catch the broad line of ripples made by a swimming muskrat. A bow wave converging across the water at the dark raised V of its head. I would stop the car and get out. Nothing. One hot evening, 3 years ago, I was standing more or less in a bush. I was stock still, looking deep into Tinker Creek from a spot on the bank opposite the house, watching a group of bluegills stare and hang motionless near the bottom of a deep, sunlit pool. I was focused for depth. I had long since lost myself, lost the creek, the day, lost everything but still amber depth. All at once, I couldn't see. And then I could. A young muskrat had appeared on the top of the water, floating on its back. I forgot about the fish. But in my surprise at having the light come on so suddenly, and at having my consciousness return to me all at once and bearing an inverted muskrat, I must have moved and betrayed myself. The kit, for now I know that it was just a young kit, righted itself so that only its head was visible above the water and swam downstream away from me. I extricated myself from the bush and foolishly pursued it. It dove sleekly, reemerged, and glided for the opposite bank. Once again it dove under a floating mat of brush lodged against the bank and disappeared. I never saw it again. But I did not know muskrats then. I waited panting and watched the shadowed bank. Now I know that I cannot outwait a muskrat who knows I am there. The most I can do is to get there quietly while it is still in its hole, so that it never knows, and wait there until it emerges. But then all I knew is that I wanted to see more muskrats. I began to look for them day and night. That summer, I haunted the bridges. I walked up creeks and down, but no muskrats ever appeared. You must just have to be there, I thought. You must have to spend the rest of your life standing in bushes. It was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and you've had your once. Then one night I saw another. I still seek them out in the cool of the evening, and I still hold my breath when rising ripples surge from under the creek's bank. The great hurrah about wild animals is that they exist at all. And the greater hurrah is the actual moment of seeing them, because they have a nice dignity and prefer to have nothing to do with me, not even as the simple objects of my vision. They show me by their very wariness what a prize it is simply to open my eyes and behold. Later in the chapter, Dillard describes an occasion when a muskrat sat beside her for 40 minutes while she watched it feed. But he never knew I was there. I never knew I was there either. For that 40 minutes, I was as purely sensitive and mute as a photographic plate. My own self-consciousness had disappeared. It now seems almost as though, had I been wired with electrodes, my EEG would have been flat. And I have often noticed that even a few minutes of this self-forgetfulness is tremendously invigorating. I wonder if we do not waste most of our energy just by spending every waking minute saying hello to ourselves. I have tried to show muskrats to other people, but it rarely works. No matter how quiet we are, the muskrats stay hidden. Maybe they sense a tense hum of consciousness, the buzz from two human beings who, in the silence, cannot help but be aware of each other, and so of themselves. Then, too, the other people invariably suffer from a self-consciousness that prevents their stalking well. It used to bother me, too. I just could not bear to lose so much dignity that I would completely alter my whole way of being for a muskrat. So I would move or look around or scratch my nose, and no muskrats would show, leaving me alone with my dignity for days on end, until I decided it was worth my time to learn from the muskrats themselves how to stalk. And that's the end of our reading. I do wish the word stalk didn't have an unpleasant connotation these days, because that's certainly not what Annie Dillard is meaning with it. What are you waiting for? That's a loaded question. It has many interpretations and contains many messages depending on how you say it. What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? It can go from mere curiosity to mild impatience to extreme exasperation. From the tone of voice, we know that our slowness or our indecision or our lack of immediate response is causing some discomfort to the other person and that we are not meeting the other's standards. I'd like to know from you what you are waiting for. I'm not impatient or exasperated, and I hold no expectations that you must meet. But I'm asking out of my own curiosity. We can learn so much from one another by knowing what we are waiting or longing for? What is it that propels you forward? What drives you? For what do you long? In a specifically religious context, we get some religious answers to the question. If we asked an Orthodox Jew, for example, we might be told, "I'm waiting for the Messiah." There were a number of Jews who were against the establishment of Israel as a nation after World War II because the Messiah had not yet appeared on earth. And for them, waiting was a serious issue. They put priorities on their sacred and their secular worlds and made the secular contingent upon the sacred. If we asked an Orthodox Christian about what he or she is waiting for, we might hear, for the return of the Messiah. At this time of year, as we are approaching this Christian season of Advent, Christians say that they are waiting for the reenactment of the arrival of Christ on earth, for the symbolic rebirth of hope in the time of darkness and despair. Advent is traditionally a season of waiting, of vigil, of penitence and sacrifice. And in these respects, it is similar to Lent in the spring for Orthodox Christians. Our Western culture is filled with symbols of waiting at this time of year. We're all familiar, I believe, with the Advent hymn, O Come, Emmanuel, a 13th century plain song that expresses longing, waiting, hoping. Perhaps some of you were raised in a traditional Christian church as I was, and you remember the lighting of the Advent candles, one per Sunday in Advent, until Christmas Eve when the central candle was lit. But even without the ritual of and symbolism of candles and calendars, the waiting before the holiday can be a time of happy anticipation. Many of us gain pleasure watching children during this time of preparation. We enjoy listening to their chatter as they help with the holiday traditions, baking goodies or trimming the tree or lighting the menorah, and as they seek our help in selecting and wrapping gifts for others. In children, we see illustrated the intensity of waiting. Now, we adults know that the holidays will come and go, and that afterwards we will be older and wiser, maybe, significantly tired and definitely poorer financially, but that the holidays will end. Children need our help in gaining the long-range perspective on the holidays so that they know that life will continue after the holidays have ended. And we can help them by putting the traditional religious messages into a liberal context for them. But sometimes even we adults need a little help with our waiting at holiday time. Some years we just wait for the holidays to be over. I've had some like that when I've decided that holidays once every 2 years would be more than sufficient. And yet we know that this is just a short-term wait, a matter of a few weeks. But what about longer-term waiting, when our entire lives themselves feel like one constant wait? As a kid, I couldn't wait to be grown up. I could hardly wait to take the training wheels off my bicycle and to learn to swim without an inner tube. And then it was waiting until I was old enough to drive. I couldn't wait to leave home for university, and then I could hardly wait to graduate from university to begin earning my living. After 11 years of working full-time, not yet a minister, I could hardly wait to enter theological school full-time. I know I'm not the first nor the last to feel an urgency about all of these phases of my life. I think it's a part of growing up. And now, not yet all grown up, but certainly well past my middle years, well into older age, my task is to find out what it all means. Not only what grown up means, but also what real and authentic are. A good description of what I mean by real and authentic is found in a children's book, The Velveteen Rabbit. One day, the young rabbit asks the skin horse, who has been around the nursery for quite some time, these questions about being real. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, asks the rabbit, or bit by bit? Being real doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time, and that's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or who have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all because once you are real, you can't be ugly except to people who don't understand. End quote. I think that might describe a number of us. A large part of being real is knowing deep down inside that it will someday end for each of us and that we will die. As we experience the deaths of others, our friends, our parents, our relatives, we're forced to deal with our own aging and our own impending death. And that's one of the reasons why memorial services, especially in the church, are so important. They give us the opportunity to relive our feelings about others' deaths and to try on our feelings about our own death. But the waiting that accompanies death is the hardest waiting that I know of. And it seems to be so for the many families I have sat with in hospital waiting rooms or in living rooms as they keep vigil for their loved ones. British novelist and theologian C.S. Lewis says it so well in his book titled A Grief Observed, which he wrote after the death of his wife, and which I often recommend to bereaved persons. He says, "And grief still feels like fear, perhaps more strictly like suspense, or like waiting, just hanging about waiting for something to happen. It gives life a permanently provisional feeling. It doesn't seem worth starting anything. I can't settle down. I yawn, I fidget, I smoke too much. Up until this, I always had too little time. Now there is nothing but time. Almost pure time, empty successiveness." End quote. So far, I've talked with you about waiting for the holidays and waiting for the holidays to be over, which is a short-term wait, and living into realness in our lives, even though we know that death awaits us, a long-term wait. Something I'm trying hard to learn as I grow up is how to balance waiting and creative action. Instead of my usual type A behavior, which you may have observed at times, and I do apologize, because sometimes I get impatient and rude, I'm trying to cultivate a more disciplined type of waiting, one that is not passive, but rather alert and intentional. As I said to you in my very first sermon back in early September, I'm trying not to be the border collie that charges the herd. I'm trying to do a little extra leading instead of charging. I'm seeking to take time to store up energy periodically for later necessary and fruitful action. I don't see this as a cop-out, but rather a way to be effective with you over the long term. It's a hard lesson for me, as it is for many of you, but it's so important for us during the holidays to find that balance between doing and waiting in a disciplined manner. And sometimes waiting is the most creative and constructive thing we can do. Annie Dillard, in her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, gives us some guidance. Remember the reading on stalking. When she waits for anything, she makes the most of every moment. She was waiting for bluegills when she suddenly saw the muskrat floating on its back in front of her. We might say she was wasting time waiting like that, but she says it is a prize simply to open her eyes and behold. When her self-awareness disappears and her EEG becomes flat, as she says, she finds herself tremendously invigorated. She is then not passive, but active, not closed to whatever is around her, but open to it. And from her passion for observing nature, she has learned how to be patient, to be focused, to be at the same time fully awake and aware, and how to learn from her mistakes. This, to me, is the essence of spiritual practice, which some people exercise in prayer, some in meditation, some in silence and contemplation, some in motion. We can learn from this kind of waiting. It is intentional, focused, and purposeful. It is not smug, self-satisfied, or self-conscious. As St. Francis of Assisi says, it is by self-forgetting that we shall find. It is by living our lives in the present moment that we create their meaning. In the congregations I have served in my specialty of interim ministry, I occasionally observe that some persons are waiting simply for the interim period between called ministers to be over. They do not wish to support the congregation while it is in transition, but will decide later if it meets their expectations. Now, you may know some of these folks. There are also some persons for whom waiting is itself intolerable. They see no reason at all for an interim period, but wish to get on with it and engage their called ministerial leadership at once. And you may know some of these folks, too. One of my intentions with congregations is that they use this time constructively, far more than a waiting period that might be passive. The congregation can use the interim time to come to terms with its past, to develop a new identity for itself, to allow new lay leadership to bubble up, and maybe some lay leadership that's been there for a while to take a bit of a rest, to forge stronger connections with the denomination and beyond, and to prepare to engage with new professional leadership. And while I'm on the subject, let me remind you again of the tool that we have for coming to terms with your history. You'll see the timeline outside in the windows just opposite your memorial sculpture. And the timeline represents the history of this congregation. I urge you to take a post-it note. You'll find a number of them there. And I urge you to use a pink post-it note to describe the events in the life of this church that made you proud of your congregation. Pink is for proud. I urge you to take a green post-it note and write on it the events in the life of this congregation that made you feel disappointed in your congregation, and that is green for grumpy. And take a yellow post-it note, and all of you, no matter how long your tenure here is, can take a yellow post-it note and write down your dreams and wishes for this congregation. And yellow stands for Yes, We Can. I hope as these ideas emerge from your mind and go onto your post-it notes that you'll take some time to let me know of your thoughts and your perceptions as well. Soon, fairly soon, the transition team and I will put this material together, and together we will offer you some what we consider our perceptions of how things have been as you come to terms with your history. I believe that you will use this time of transition best if you maintain a certain tolerance for ambiguity during the interim period, and if you do not expect yourselves to find immediate and permanent answers to your needs for security. Answers will come to you. You must be open to them and ready for them in a state of awareness and inner balance and readiness for action. It all comes around to that question about waiting. The next time someone says to you, "What are you waiting for?" you can think of Annie Dillard and her experiences with the muskrats and say to yourself, if not to the questioner, "I'm not waiting, I'm stalking." So may it be.
As we leave this sacred space, may our truest selves transcend the dissonance of daily distractions as we join the spiraling infinite dance pulsing unseen throughout all creation. So may it be.